You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Stephen Schofield. He's calling from Canada. Stephen, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Stephen, I know a variety of works that you've produced over the years, but let's begin with, what is it that you're working on at the moment in your studio? And you're in Montreal, is that correct?
Yes, I am. And I'm working on a large public art project. It's five different sculptures on the Jean Mans, which is the street that runs beside the Musée d'Art Contemporain, the Contemporary Art Museum in Montreal. And so I'm working on the five sculptures right at the moment. I'm working with subcontractors, with a foundry, with a fabricator, because there's a lot of different materials involved in the project.
And what is the theme of it, or what will the sculptures, public works, look like?
Well, it's always kind of hard to describe something just like this, but they're really kind of five different moments. I didn't want the pieces to look all the same. I wanted them to be linked more in terms of a narrative. Maybe if I told you the central piece is a large piece that is assembled a lot of the ways that I work with, let's say, cloth or with paper. It's kind of based on a pattern of a body. It's a 5 meters long, so it's about seven. I'm not sure how long 5 meters is. I think it's 17 feet. 17 feet long. It's in Corten steel, and it's kind of and it's being transported by a group of small children, sort of joyously and maliciously carrying this figure on his back. I was kind of thinking of the images of the end of communism when statues of Stalin, for instance, were being torn down. But it also has a slightly crowd surfing quality to it, too. So there's kind of a combination of something kind of light and gentle, but also something rather brutal about that central image. And the other pieces work off that central theme.
And that theme is sounds like one based in, which is similar to some of your other work, in dreams and in memory kind of moments.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, the first piece, for instance, is just a man and a woman, and she's sitting on a chair, and she's gesturing to the man. It's a real. I tried to find a gesture that was both affirmative and gentle, but kind of an odd gesture that the wrist sort of moved up and the finger just lifted up slightly. He's repeating the same gesture, but he's also climbing on the back of the chair. So one could imagine that he might fall off the chair, and to a certain extent, he's linked to the effigy piece that's further down. The other thing to mention is that she's dressed, but he's naked, and I wanted him to be kind of vulnerably naked. He's not a particularly good-looking man. He's not ugly either, but there's a kind of middle-aged quality to him. There's still sort of tone to his muscles. But so I wanted that kind of simple nudity as part of the piece.
I like that. And when do you expect that piece will be done? It sounds like a big project.
It is a big project, and actually I know when it's going to be done, because the city has scheduled the inauguration for May 16th, and it's because they want to start the 275th anniversary of Montreal with the inauguration of those five sculptures. I mean, you might not know, but the 275th anniversary of Montreal happens to coincide with the 150th anniversary of Canada. So they're kind of double celebrations.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, so that is quite an event. That will be...
Yes.
And this type of work, I'd like to maybe, you know, move back to when, you know, you first began making work that was kind of bordering on this kind of world of dreams, of memories, of that wasn't always in your work, right? That kind of revisiting what to me almost looks like childhood and these other kind of narrative issues weren't always in your work. Is that correct?
Well, I think they were, but maybe I think I often worked in a my earlier work often was somewhat let's say a more detailed view of the body, so that it tended to have a slightly more abstract quality, and I was more interested in maybe thinking of the body as a membrane in my earlier work. And I didn't necessarily think of the whole body. I was more interested in the kind of the local activities, or the idea of the shape of the inside of your mouth and in your tongue. I mean, I've always been fascinated by where does the outside end? You know, you can sort of that the outside is where your hands are, but if you put your finger in your mouth, is it still outside? At what point does it stop being outside? So my earlier work was more about those kinds of questions, but they were let's say more concentrated in a kind of detailed parameter.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then as it evolved, was it also bringing in, did narrative start coming into it more and more? Is how I'm seeing it, or do you feel that there was always that narrative process?
Well, sometimes the narrative was in books that I've read. I mean, there was a book that I really loved, Gogol's Nose. Not actually a book, it's a short story, but it's a wonderful short story about a Russian commissaire who wakes up in the morning and realizes his nose is no longer in his face, and he rushes out to the street and says to people, "This is a disaster, my nose is left." And people sort of say, "Are you sure?" And, you know, he says, "Yes, it's not there," you know, and finally says, "Oh, you're right, your nose is not there." And so there's this kind of absurd thing that goes on through the morning until the afternoon. He sees his nose parading, but in the uniform of a commissaire that's a higher rank than he is. So he dare not speak to his nose because his nose is already in a rank higher than he is. And so there's this whole ridiculous story about him trying to get the nose back on his face. So, I mean, the pieces that I did from that, you know, that short story I didn't deal with the commissaire, but I dealt with the idea of sort of a shape that can be a part and a whole at the same time. I mean, it's a synecdoche, you know, is where the part stands in for the whole, or the whole stands in for the part. And so, yeah, I think the narrative parts were there, but they were sometimes things I read rather than things I remembered.
Now, it's fascinating to hear that story. I know that story, but to say that in connection with that piece suddenly makes a lot of sense to me. As viewers watch it, though, and are coming upon that, they don't often know that book that you read and the kind of narrative that's behind it, do they?
No, they don't. Well, you know, it's just like that. I mean, some people do, some don't, and some will read about it. Some will be curious why it's called, Gogol's Nose. But you're quite right. Not everybody knows the story. You just have to live with that.
And that's an interesting approach, because then the viewer, and this is, I guess, often the case, you know, artists have influences or narratives that are somewhat hidden. And then the viewer has to piece it together from what's there, has to assemble parts, so to speak, so that it makes a coherent whole. Do you think that's what's happening, or am I kind of overreaching?
Well, no, I think you're right. I think often people say, "Oh, you're forcing the viewer to do this." You never force the viewer to do anything. The viewer can be seduced into doing something or cajoled into doing something, but you can't really force them into doing anything. So you can leave it as an invitation to pursue, and whether they do or not is another thing. But I think often work on different, you know, they do work on different levels. Maybe someone would be disappointed to know that came from Gogol's story. I'm not sure, but I think that there's enough in the piece, in the kinds of those pieces are, just to say, because you can't see them, but they're rather small pieces, and almost everything is about how I sewed the seams of either silk organza or polyester organza or plastic. I was very interested in how you could fill up any one of these sort of bag-like forms with cement, and with one of them, the cement seeps through. It's all, it's kind of almost sifted by the polyester and reforms another crust on the outside, a bit like, you know, a loaf of bread or something like that. Whereas the polyester organza, the cement doesn't leak through. It left a kind of trace in the organza, and the one that was cast in plastic, the cement took the shiny the shine, the polished side of the plastic. So it was quite brilliant, but it's just because it was cast in a piece of clean plastic. So I think there's lots of details that people feel and may identify with. They recognize some kind of experience in their own life. I often have to say it tends to be food in my case anyhow. Things look like food to me all the time. I don't know why, but I think my work looks like food a lot of the time too.
That's very interesting. Yeah, I you know, now that you say that, I see that, but that wasn't something I would read into it. That's kind of funny and very interesting. Let's move back even further. When you were getting out of school, what was the kind of first work you were making? Because there seems to be such a line between all your work and what you've just described, from you know, the public art to other works. It seems like such rich terrain in terms of how you're exploring the medium and also layers of narratives. What was some of the earlier works that you were doing, let's say just out of school, before you had shows?
Well, they were a lot about gardens. They almost had always a garden form. Most of the pieces were in clay. A lot of them had forms that suggested just the beginning of a sprout, for instance, or the kind of folding of sepals, or just kind of the architecture of plants was quite present, and they were often quite sexy. I think one of the things about working with clay is one tends to start giving a kind of meaty, juicy quality to the clay. It's almost irresistible, and I certainly didn't resist it in that group of pieces. But I think there's also a kind of strange kind of violence in a garden. You don't think of it quite the same that way, but you know, you sow a line of, let's say, carrots, and several weeks later you decide, well, I'm going to take out, you know, three out of every four so that, you know, I have a big carrot. I mean, it's sort of kind of aborting all these other little carrots that we're planning on growing too. But I mean, there's that kind of the brutality of trimming things, weeding, as I said, or something like with carrots, where you're reducing the number of carrots so that the ones that survive are going to be nice and big. And I liked having something that suggested that kind of ambiguous quality of a garden, something bucolic, but also something that there might be some kind of violence hidden there too.
Now, that's a very interesting way to look at, like, a garden and violence. I mean, it almost reminds me of kind of a controversial theory by Slavoj Žižek, who proposed, and I don't know if you had seen him talk about this. He's a Slovenian philosopher,
yes.
But he would talk about love as being, and I'm probably paraphrasing it not nearly as eloquently as he put it, but love as being an act of violence in itself, to love someone exclusively, because we do that at the expense of so many others that we could be loving, and that we have to, you know, stop our feelings towards all those others and only love one. So there's this kind of inherent violence in the act of love, you know, with between two people. Do you agree with that? Or, well, I mean, is that part of how you were thinking there? Because, I mean, I think it's a fascinating theory, but it's also seems to almost relate to that kind of garden idea of violence in the garden. And there's undertones of violence, I suppose, in that respect in other works of yours. But
yes, I think so, for sure. I think there is that double-edged thing of, you know, concentrating on, you know, me, my family. It becomes a unit that excludes what's not inside it. So yeah, there is that, and you can see that. People on vacation, it's a very good example, you know, unbridled concentration on themselves, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's fascinating. So that was a theme then, in fact, that continued throughout your work. Maybe we should talk about, you know, as we're getting towards the end of this interview, to do it kind of in reverse. After those initial works, and what was the first show that you had? Do you remember what gallery and when you had your first show?
Well, yes, actually, I was a student when I had my first show at Miragada in Montreal. I'd been studying with Ulysse Contois, who was a wonderful sculptor. He had a lovely playful quality. He had these kinetic sculptures that can be moved and reconstructed. And he was also a very beautiful painter, very small paintings, very intense, and kind of very seductive awkwardness to his method of painting. And he showed with Mère Gadar, and he introduced me to her. And I had three galleries. There's three shows in that gallery. And that was a pretty big deal in 1975 and 76. Yeah.
And those shows, were they of the plants then? Was that ceramic work?
Yes, yes. There was, well, the first one was of the garden pieces. The second one were more of, there were maybe quieter spaces. There were more architectural spaces. One of them I was really interested in, the staircase in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. It's like, instead of parallel steps, there's a, very difficult to explain, but kind of a triangle on the left-hand side and a triangle on the right. So these crossovers of triangles, I found that really quite beautiful as a form. And so there was a small box where the sort of the staircase went down to the bottom of the box. It was just also in clay. Yeah, so that was the second show I did with Mère Gadar. And yes,
you know, I mean, that's very exciting. I'm sorry, go on. And they were what? There was two other shows for that.
They were linked in the sense that both of them were about that sort of circumscribed, you know, hortus conclusus, the idea of sort of the garden as being this inside world. Yeah, I think that was quite, there was a kind of quiet intimacy to both groups of pieces in those two shows.
And your work has evolved, you know, in so dramatically than then, and in that span of time also the art world has changed from 75 to 2015. It's a vastly different place. In the 70s, really, it wasn't even so much a world of collectors or how it's talked about now. You've watched all those transitions, and your art and your career has survived all of that. How in looking back on that, how does the transition seem to now? And in one sense, it seems that you're making the, I know this is kind of a broad question, but it seems that your work is still of a piece, but of a theme. And at the same time, the art world itself has changed dramatically. So I would imagine that the reception of your work, and perhaps it ties into the success of your work, has also shifted and changed in response, is what I'm saying, to the cultural shift that's happened in the art world in the last 30 years.
Well, yes, I think that, well, certainly you're quite right. Things have changed. I mean, my idea of what a body is and the fragility of a body has changed. That's maybe not because of the art world, but because it is 30 years later. But that sense of, you know, occupying a body where you sort of feel you're still seeing the world the way you saw it before, but you just look at your hands and think, oh my God, those are my hands. You know, they're not hands I was expecting to see this morning, but there they are. You know, they've got the liver spots on them and wrinkles and things like that. And so that's a change that certainly affects how I think about my own work. But in terms of the larger shift in the art world, it is fascinating to see here in Canada, there's the beginning of a real market. There's a beginning of people being able to live from making their work without teaching or without running a sideline in construction. Those are pretty amazing things to see happen. It's not my case, incidentally. I teach here in Montreal, but I certainly see younger artists who are living a much different life than I was before.
You're probably in a position now where you no longer have to teach. You've been quite successful with your art. It's that teaching is part of what you like to do. Is that correct?
Well, I do actually like teaching. I enjoy partly just leaving my studio a couple of days of the week too is part of there is that, but I work in a school where there are five technicians in the sculpture studio. They're actually happy technicians, which is not always the case, having taught in many schools. They're happy and they're things people, they enjoy doing things, and so there's a real positive sense in that school. So I draw from that. I mean, I believe I contribute to it too, but it certainly is a powerful draw for thinking about different ways of doing things too. I'm in a conversation with my students about what I'm doing and what they're doing. I do talk to them a lot about my work. I mean, I can't avoid it really, basically, because they see stuff out there. So there you go. So
right.
I really enjoy that kind of conversation and that back and forth. I think I was very lucky with some of the people that taught me, like Ulysse Cantois or Vera Frankel, who's another artist who maybe you know of in Toronto, a very good artist. And so I feel open to being a similar person to other people.
And then lastly, if you know, there's listeners that are, you know, from different parts of the world, but also Canada for this particular series, is there anywhere you want to guide listeners to? There'll be links in this interview to some of your work. Is there anywhere that you want to tell people to see? Like, for example, the public work that you're building
well,
now
yes.
and finishing, where that will be, or any other upcoming exhibits at your gallery.
Well, it's a permanent piece, and so, yes, in May, it'll be the mayor will cut the string and we'll take off the white Tyvek and it'll be all out there. And so it'll be the 16th of May, and I'll be showing some of the clay pieces that I did in preparation, studies that I did, because I did a lot of test pieces in porcelain. And I'll be showing them those at Joyce Yehuda Gallery, who represents me here in Montreal. And that will be some weeks after the opening of the, after the inauguration of the public sculpture.
And the public sculpture, that inauguration takes place exactly where? Where is that public sculpture?
It's on Jean Mance. Jean Mance, incidentally, was nurse that founded the first hospital in Montreal. She trekked up to the mountain and in what was considered to be the wilderness and set up Hôtel Dieu Hospital. Now it's like in this downtown Montreal, but at the time people thought it was the Health Half Acre. Anyhow, it's named after her, and it's Jean Mance, and it's in downtown Montreal between St. Catherine and Manny-l'Évêque.
Stephen, thanks so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work.
Well, thank you. It was an enjoyable conversation for me, too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.